Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com. Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
We are proud members of the Spy Podcast Network. Find out more at www.spypodcasts.com.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised.
We're at a really key phase in the war. So just about a week ago, there was reports from U.S. intelligence assessments. And as we've seen, right prior to the invasion, U.S. intelligence assessments have shown themselves to have a pretty good track record recently, saying that Ukraine had about 6 weeks for more offensive actions.
Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, we're joined by Eurasia analyst Matthew Orr, who works for RAIN, Risk Assistance Network and Exchange. On this episode, we discuss Russia's war on Ukraine, and we take a look at what to expect this winter from a military and political perspective, and we also take a look at Putin and his motivations. I hope you find this episode informative. Thank you for listening.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Matthew, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you very much for joining me today. So first of all, please can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your work at RAIN?
Sure. My name is Matthew Orr. I've been working at RAIN for about 2 years now. I'm a Eurasia analyst, so I cover basically all the former Soviet Union, excluding the Baltic states. But, you know, yeah. I do plenty of stuff related to them as well. And yeah, so I follow political, economic, all geopolitical developments in the region, field questions about those developments from clients, and of course, write for our commercial website, which is known as Stratfor. But you can find all of our analysis at RAIN or RAINnetwork.com.
Excellent, excellent. So what drew your interest in sort of Russia and Eastern Europe?
Yeah, I was really interested in the transition of society from one ideology to another. I was always fascinated about how people of the older generation could grow up, be trained in a certain ideology, and then watch that entire ideology fall apart in front of their eyes, see the difficulties that they went through in the 1990s, where a lot of Russians felt that basically, they had been kind of abandoned by the West. On the one hand, the West was trying to invite them in, but because the standard of living collapsed so much in Russia, there was a lot of bitterness and anger that grew. And then, of course, we saw what that led the rise of, which is Vladimir Putin and his ideology, and the way that it had to slowly reveal itself. Because if Putin's ambitions and dreams and what he really saw for Russia had been revealed kind of at the time, it probably would not have been politically popular, and I don't think Yeltsin would have named him as a successor, but that's kind of getting ahead of the question. But yeah, and then I was trying to understand how that led to the developments we were already seeing, because I started getting really interested in Russia a couple years prior to the annexation of Crimea. And even before then, I actually showed up for Russia after having taken Russian for some time at university, and showed up there right after the annexation. And it was just a fascinating time to be there, because it was this time where, you know, a lot of people were starting to, in Russia for the first time, were asking themselves about, what is Russia's destiny? What's our role in this? The economic situation that had been improving in Russia for many years on the back of high oil and gas prices was now kind of changing. And I was there when the ruble had its first collapse from about 32 rubles to a dollar to something like 80 in a matter of weeks. So I was witness to a lot of these incidents where Russians would go to try to get their hands on hard assets to try before their currency depreciated and things like that. All of that and my experiences there after having gone for the first time really got me interested in this question of ideology. And I think that the point that really kind of put an exclamation point on it is when I studied abroad at a Russian university, the political science department. And there I met students who were, you know, brilliant students. This was a top five university in Russia. And they could, you know, wax about Aristotle or certain things they had been learning about political philosophy at the university. But then when I would ask them, you know, a simple question about civics, like, well, for example, who's your representative at the Russian State Duma? A lot of these very, you know, educated Russians, young Russians, usually we see a lot of these youth at universities as politically engaged or at least wanting to be. But even they didn't know basics about the Russian political system. And that's when it really kind of the light bulb started going off that this is really about civics and ideology and a failure to sincerely, effectively train people in Russia's new ideology in line with its constitution, et cetera.
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned that about the failure of civics, because I kind of feel in Western society, we're kind of going a little bit through that now, because there's a lot of young people who are very, and older people, two people my generation, who are very politically active, but then they can't answer who their local MP is, and they don't really understand how certain things do and don't work, and it leads to sort of frustration and things.
Yeah, I think it's a global thing. So if it's a problem, you know, in our societies, where presumably we even still have these institutions and mechanisms that are supposed to bring that. Imagine in a country where none of this was ever really set up or taken seriously. And so it's really not surprising that this is where we ended up.
Yeah. Was there anything else that you saw there whilst you're in Russia that kind of later sort of played out with Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
I think the other thing that comes to mind is, of course, the TV propaganda and what it's like to be in this other information environment. I mean, I remember when I was there for the first time in 2014, it's when a lot of that, graphic nationalist rhetoric, violent rhetoric had really started to enter the propaganda mainstream for the first time. And at the time, you know, we thought this was shocking. We thought, you know, as a Westerner, I immediately kind of felt how this was similar to fascism and, you know, classic examples of propaganda that we would have learned about. But in Russia, it didn't seem to be striking people in that way necessarily. Mm. And then what happened is, of course, over the years since, a lot of us got became complacent about it and kind of think, well, there's no real repercussions of this propaganda, because, I mean, look, they've been saying these things for years, but that doesn't mean that, you know, Russia's going to invade Ukraine or that, you know, X, Y, or Z is going to happen. But then, you know, as we've seen recently, the propaganda actually does have an effect, and there was a long time kind of informational preparation for the invasion that I think that for a lot of even analysts and experts, we kind of begin to dismiss. There was actually an old joke in Russian that, what will the vegetables have tonight? Well, the vegetables will have red meat. The vegetables is referring to kind of older Russians, kind of more homebodies in Russia who just became used to having their dose of this kind of nationalist red meat every night. And yeah, that's certainly another thing that struck me. The other thing I would probably add here is just the the presence of Soviet iconography and images are still up all over the country, which was really astounding to me, again, related to this ideology question, because I would have thought that, you know, or if you go to Eastern Europe, of course, they had lustration and they took down these monuments and they, et cetera, or they put them in museums. In Russia, there was no illustration of the officials of the regime, and then if we talk about monuments and iconography, there was just a little bit. But I mean, you'll go to town square, and you know, there's the hammer and sickle up everywhere you see. All the streets are named women. All of the communist revolutionaries, for the most part, still have their names up all over the country, and that does have an effect, right? Because if you're a child, for example, and you're going to the Lenin Mausoleum or whatever it may be. You're still saying, well, huh, on the one hand, we're supposed to have a totally different ideology, but on the other hand, we're still everywhere celebrating the figures of this ideology that we claim to have disavowed. So I think that's another kind of piece of this ideological contradiction that is having that helps explain and understand what you're seeing in Russia.
Yeah. Do you think, because obviously there's people prior to Putin, Yeltsin, but do you think Putin sort of purposely sort of played into that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a famous kind of, it's not really confirmed, but there's a famous anecdote about how Yeltsin prepared the documents and the institutions and had the order essentially ready for Putin to remove the Lenin Mausoleum and have Lenin buried. But so grows the kind of apocryphal telling of the story. Putin rejected that plan, even though Yeltsin had started preparing it for him. Putin did start leaning into all that, right? Mm. He most famously, Yeltsin started to change that. He had a coal commission set up and they wrote a new Russian national anthem, different tune, different lyrics. There's a British documentarian named Adam Curtis. I don't know if you've heard of him,
yes.
But he actually had a really good piece come out on Russia recently that I definitely recommend to all of your listeners. And there he does a very good job of actually showing the work of this Russian National Anthem Committee in conditions where Russia is in economic chaos and collapsing. And the writers are, you know, struggling because they're trying to, you know, extort these high ideals at a time when around them they're seeing a lot of degradation. And then, of course, Putin reversed that as well. He took back the Soviet tune and just changed the lyrics to have it referred to Russia, right? So, yeah, Putin has really leaned into kind of preserving, and a lot of his ideology is actually based off of the continuity through the Soviet era, specifically this idea of the countries related to the title of the name of this podcast, right? The continuity of the country's security services as being the real source of statehood for Russia. And that's the only thread that really ties all three of these entities, Tsarist Russia, Soviet Russia, current Russia. It's the only thing that really unites them.
Mm, and Putin being a true KGB man, you can understand why he went for that.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Well, thank you so much for that. So can you give us some background on why Russia invaded Ukraine?
Sure. I think that there's obviously, you know, it's like we're going to be talking about this for a long time, right? Mm. People ask, like, why did the Soviet Union collapse? And there's like a whole scattershot of reasons, right? It's that the ideology, the main reason, in my opinion, is that Gorbachev he realized that the ideology needed an updating, and it was the ideas in his head about democracy and what real democracy looks like, because democracy had already always been celebrated, but so he wanted to realize that. But there was also the economic issues, war in Afghanistan, culture, rock, etc. But it's going to be the same way with this invasion of Ukraine. There's going to be a lot of theories about, you know, or debates, if you will, about what really caused this. My opinion about what really caused this is it's largely related to kind of geoeconomics and the Russian elite's perceptions of what Ukraine leaving Russia's kind of geoeconomic sphere would mean for Russia itself, the political calculation. So what do I mean by that? I mean that Ukraine was the second biggest economy within the Soviet Union of the Soviet republics. Ukraine had been one of Russia's top three trading partners at the time that Putin came to power, and there had always been those economic links. Of course, Ukraine post 2014 was moving, or particularly after 2014, was moving away from Russia's sphere of influence. It was integrating with the EU. The European values were spreading the what was the slogan in Ukraine? It was we just want Ukraine to be a normal European country, as they would say, right? Become, you know, get their corruption levels at least up to, you know, Romania, right? And pretty basic realistic goals that I think are pretty, you know, rational for the Ukrainians, right? And what the problem with that for Russia is A, that Ukraine totally leaving their sphere of influence as a result of those processes would make Russia's kind of current integration less attractive, right? Because then you would have Belarus sitting there going, well, hold on, shouldn't we do the same thing? I mean, we should probably also reorient. And then you would also have the Caucasus saying, well, hold on, the European project and the economic benefits of being tied to the West are so high. And then it would go all the way to Kazakhstan, and we're still seeing that today, where these entities are saying, "Well, hold on, it's more profitable for us to be economically integrated with the West and to have support those connections than to hamstring our trade by being in a customs union with Russia and, you know, folding to Russian regulations and rules, etc." And then, of course, the cherry on the cake is, of course, that what happens if people come to power in Ukraine saying, we just want to be a normal European country, and it works out for them, then you have all those people in Russia going, oh, we just want to be a normal European country, and it could potentially work out for us. And so that's why we saw the repressions of Navalny and his organization, the crackdown on big tech and free press within the country. And all of that, it was basically this use of this geopolitical standoff with NATO and the West as an excuse to, you know, right, push back against these political forces that Putin thought were, you know, a danger to his regime, his friends, family, his kind of entire governing network. And of course, even at the end of the day, the FSB and the security service.
It's brilliant. I mean, I find that idea that if, like, Ukraine, as you're saying, becomes a successful European country and Russians are going to turn around and sort of turn on their leadership and say, hey, what's going wrong here? I think that's a real big fear, isn't it? I think.
Oh, absolutely. And that's kind of why they had to do this sooner rather than later, which is that, you know, Putin's popularity was falling before this. Everything was kind of stagnant. The country's economy was already stagnating and poor. So they needed this entire paradigm shift domestically to really set a new normal and say all of this political speech that, you know, for decades, Navalny, his views, liberal views in Russia broadly in Russia were totally normal, right? But now an entirely new bar of repression has to be set to stop those ideas from becoming more popular.
Yeah, indeed. So prior to the war, did you think Putin would invade Ukraine?
Really interesting question. Of course, I remember the months really leading up to the invasion so clearly, and because it was just such an emotionally charged time. I remember writing my first piece about the renewed buildup in the very first week of November, when CIA Director Burns went to Moscow, and we wrote about that on our site immediately, because it was immediately clear that something is, this buildup is very serious. And so we, you know, we warned people about this possibility immediately. Then once we got to December, as this was continuing, we kept coming back to the same question, which is that, well, there are really two problems here. A, the Russians could not accumulate the amount of forces needed to achieve what they were threatening. Right? I mean, you couldn't. So they were threatened. They were essentially threatening Kiev. They were threatening Northern Ukraine, and clearly talking about regime change. That's what they were threatening, but they didn't have enough forces to do that. So, that was always what our analysis was kind of hung up on, is, well, how are they going to accomplish this thing if they clearly don't have the forces to do it? That's kind of the main reason. That's one of the main reasons that we kept kind of thinking, well, hold on, maybe this is not going to be a full scale invasion. Maybe it's to threaten that in the negotiation, hope that the negotiation with the West gets sufficient concessions. And Putin's comments after the invasion, literally the day after, when he spoke to the oligarchs, high ranking business people, he said something like, I was stunned. I really thought that they were going to cave, that they were going to give me these concessions, or that instead of doing this so-called full-scale invasion, that they would regroup their forces, concentrate more on the Donbas, concentrate more on southern Ukraine, try to encircle the Donbas. And kind of the grand irony is that basically, if Russia had done that, it would have been way, they probably would control all of the Donbas right now. But precisely because they threatened and then attempted this more grand scale invasion with political interplay, try to encircle Kiev, that's actually obstructed the achievement of their much more minimalist, limited goals, right? Yeah. Securing Donbas, et cetera. So I really didn't think it was going to happen because and the second reason is that we also knew that it would be a strategic disaster for Russia. The big data point that just came out on this today is that the International Energy Agency said that Russia's energy exports will never reach the volumes that they were at the pre-war level. And by 2030, the overall amount could fall something like 50% in terms of volume. And the revenue would not fall that much, but it would also fall. So it was like, you know, if Russia is going to blow a hole in the biggest source of its state revenues, and that's going to be a permanent reduction that it can't replace. I mean, and then you add on all the other factors, the civil aviation, the investment climate being so poor, it would just seem like from an economic standpoint that this would not be a strategic success for Russia. So those were the two main reasons, right? The military impossibility of it and the strategic blunder that it almost certainly will wind up being. So we didn't think it was likely.
Yeah. I remember in the build up there was this sort of sense that once sort of Russia went in that they would kind of walk over the Ukrainian army. And even I bought a little bit into that. I was thinking that Ukraine might last days, but you know, bless them, they're still going. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I think that whole topic, right? Kiev's gonna fall in 3 days is such an interesting little kind of microcosm of a lot of things.
Yeah.
I have to admit that I, right, precisely because I did not think the invasion would happen for those two reasons, within those 3 days, I begin to think, Putin must be so sure in his confidence of the political interplay needed to remove Zelensky and install some pro-Ukrainian leadership, even though I knew it was patently impossible on its face. I was like, the fact that he would go through this, he must be so sure that element of this is going to work.
Mm.
So even I had that moment of doubt where I was like, well, maybe, but I didn't think militarily that they would collapse. I knew that they would stick up for the fight for their homeland, stick up for their independence. And I think an American professor, Timothy Schneider, is actually giving this Yale course on Ukrainian history right now. And in the first lecture, the central idea is that the reason that narratives like Ukraine will fall in 3 days is precisely because we don't know, people in general don't know Ukrainian history.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember even over the holidays before the invasion, you know, I would have, you know, parents of relatives and people like that saying, well, Ukraine, isn't that part of Russia? or things like that. And there was always kind of this throwing in of Ukraine with Russia in terms of its identity and things like that. And I think that's actually the almost subconscious, unconscious source for a lot of that thinking is that we were never taught Ukrainian history like we were taught, I don't know, French or British history, but there's enough there to tell the story. It has a similar national story to all the other countries of Europe. And so that's how I also kind of think it's interesting to think about that question of why the 3 days fall.
Yeah. I mean, I remember I was very guilty of kept calling Ukraine the Ukraine, and it was just this habit. And I don't honestly know exactly where I picked it up from, but it's sort of that thinking of it being a former Soviet state and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The reason for that is, so in Russian, you say na Ukraine.
Yeah.
So you use a different preposition to refer to it. Then, of course, when that came through German and eventually English, it led to this grammatical thing where they started referring to Ukraine as a territory, just as its own political state, but just like a, you think of like a flat area. It's just a thing, as an object essentially. And that's kind of the origin of that.
Yeah. No, I was very guilty of that. And when all this happened, I slowly, quite quickly realized my error and did my best to correct that. So obviously the war's been sort of going on for some time now. Are you able to kind of give us a quick update on the war, where we're at now, and any key points that you've sort of observed recently?
Yeah, we're at a really key phase in the war. So just about a week ago, there was reports from U.S. intelligence assessments. And as we've seen, right, prior to the invasion, U.S. intelligence assessments have shown themselves to have a pretty good track record recently, saying that Ukraine had about 6 weeks for more offensive actions in Ukraine. There was essentially, I think, three or four reasons for that. The main reason is that the weather is going to change. The season's going to change in Ukraine, right? So it's going to become a lot cloudier. And when it's cloudier, that's going to obstruct satellite imagery. Need that's so critical for the Ukrainians. They're targeting with the HIMARS, the precision systems, et cetera. Their intelligence gathering of Russian forces. Related to that, you're going to have more rain. Of course, the rain, it's the famous Rasputitsa, right? The rainy season that obstructed Nazi Germany's invasion of the Soviet Union and things like that. So it's going to make it a lot more difficult for all kinds of vehicles to move across southern Ukraine in these muddy areas. The other reason is that the foliage is already falling off the trees. So a lot of these defensive positions that are dug under, right, the trees are now going to be exposed. And that's going to lead to this highly kind of chaotic phase where these previously secure positions are now visible and the armies are going to reposition relatedly. And then finally, of course, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers mobilizing who in the coming weeks are going to be reaching the front. And so that's going to make it a lot harder for Ukraine to advance. So that's kind of the short answer, is that the Ukrainians still have this short period to continue advancing. And they're going to keep doing that up in the Luhansk region, possibly in the Zaporizhia region. They're going to continue to hold in the Donetsk region, but that's also where Russia is going to continue concentrating. And then, of course, the most interesting part of the front is everything related to Kherson, the city on the Dnieper River, that southern bridgehead that the Russians have on the western, or as the Ukrainians called it, the right bank of the river. Our kind of view on that is that the Russians are pouring in resources to hold that bridgehead. But it's interesting why they're doing that, because it's simultaneously they can continue to hold it if they just keep pouring in enough resources. But in the long term, it's not the best place for them to be funneling in these resources. It's so the supplying the area is so difficult because of crossing the river on these barges that are constantly getting destroyed. And so, I mean, on the one hand, the Ukrainians probably can't take it back quickly. But on the other hand, it's my assessment that it's an indefensible position for the Russians in the long term because of the supply difficulties. So I think we can comfortably say that the Ukrainians will retake it eventually. We just don't know if that's going to be within a month or, you know, potentially in many months or years. But I mean, after that, the war is going to become this more slow grinding pace, is my assessment. Russia is going to threaten more offensives,
yeah,
including through Belarus to renew the threat to Kiev from the north. But because in Putin's mind, Putin thinks that, the Ukrainians, he's kind of alluded to this logic publicly. He said the Ukrainians were so close, you know, in late March to striking a deal with us, but then they left negotiations after we withdrew from Kiev in northern Ukraine. So in Putin's mind, Putin has said, the reason they left is because we removed the threat to their capital. And so I think he's very attracted to this idea that if we can just return the threat to all of Ukraine again, then we can bring them back. And that's also what these rocket attacks all across Ukraine, which are having a big effect, destroying power stations, infrastructure. It's about keeping the threat to all of Ukraine and making the country unlivable, right? And that's also related to what we talked about earlier of how Putin wants to make Ukraine into a destroyed country to show other countries in its geoeconomic orbit that this is what happens to you if you oppose us, and domestically to signal how their resolve to do this.
I have a morbid question.
I
feel ashamed of myself for even thinking this, but I'm sort of slightly surprised, but again, this is me, not a military expert, that Russia hasn't chosen to try and take out Zelensky in any proper way. I mean, obviously earlier in the war, there was talk of hit squads and things like that, but surely Putin just needs to fire rockets, doesn't he? I don't know. It's
well,
horrible. Yeah.
Yeah, no. So I think, I mean, it's been reported a lot, and I think we can safely assume that within the initial weeks of the invasion, there was an order, an attempt to kill or capture Zelensky. That seems pretty plausible to me. Just because, right, that was probably what was needed as part of their crazy political interplay plan, part of the invasion. But to me, the main constraint on that is pretty clear, which is that if Russia is assassinating Zelensky, then they're opening the door for 40 million Ukrainians to assassinate Putin,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And assassinating Putin would have an equally detrimental effect on Russia, its political stability, its future. And so that's potentially an escalatory path that Russia does actually not want to take this down. The security services of Ukraine have demonstrated an ability to operate within Russia as we saw with the things related to the presumed assassination of Alexander Dugin's daughter, the attempt to assassinate him, presumably. But also, you may remember in the opening months, there was a lot of reports of sabotage at major Russian research centers, manufacturing plants. I think we can presume that possibly some of that was related to the security services of Ukraine. And so, I mean, the Ukrainians speak Russian. They can live in Russia. They can be undercover in Russia.
Yeah.
And it would definitely be dangerous for Putin to assassinate Zelensky for that reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I really hope he doesn't, because Zelensky's become a sort of Churchillian figure. I mean, he's probably the most inspirational politician I've ever seen in my lifetime, to be quite honest.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that's such a fascinating element of this, because I learned Ukrainian in graduate school, and then actually lived there for almost a full summer, right around the time of Zelensky's election.
Oh,
and
wow.
I covered Zelensky's rise very, very closely with a group of students, and we held focus groups with Ukrainians about what they thought about Zelensky, and he was so fascinating through his use of social media to kind of, you know, went over the youth vote, and then he of course won the election in a landslide. Mm. I at that time was very skeptical of him, because I saw him as part of a trend that I didn't like of these. I mean, he's a former comedian who was a TV producer essentially, and I thought he was an instrument of the oligarch Kolomoisky, who was his main benefactor, Zelensky had worked for his entire life, produced content for Kolomoisky's TV channels, etc. And there was very clear that was a deep relationship, and I was very concerned about that. And I just didn't think that Zelensky was competent in matters of state, as opposed to the former president Petro Poroshenko. And so I saw Zelensky as kind of this populist kind of social media president figure that I was very kind of alarmed by, particularly following the rise of Donald Trump and what that had done to the United States, and of course even, you know, Brexit and think, you know, how that had kind of really divided that country. And I was worried about potential the divide within Ukraine that he would cause, and his competence. But then what I only really realized after the invasion is that he has been such an effective communicator, in a way that a conditional Petro Poroshenko or somebody of his type would not have been, and would not have been able to unite the country as much as Zelensky has. And yeah, a lot of that is due to his professionalism in front of the camera, his ability to deliver lines with such eloquence and accuracy, his comfort public speaking. I remember his very first speech after the start of the invasion. It was just fantastic. It was just emotional. He hit every little emotional cue of it, and that's what rallied the country, united the country. Of course, his background as a Russian speaker also really kind of helped integrate a lot of these areas in Ukraine that had been felt kind of disaffected by, by the it's a long story that we don't have to get into, but he was good at uniting those people. And so I've realized now that he has, as you said, he's been extremely effective, not only within Ukraine, but abroad, at kind of taking the Ukrainian message there and being an effective communicator.
Yeah, I hope one day I can have a chat with him. I'd love to find out about his guiding philosophy. It's not something I'd go into now, because obviously I wouldn't want Putin to listen and say, oh, that's how he's thinking. But I'd love to know what his inspirations were, because in a weird way, because he's not that much older than me. I'm 41, so Zelensky thinks, what, 45, 47, something like that. And I'm wondering if some of the pop culture references we might share, I don't know. It's really interesting.
Yeah, but you bring up a good point, which is that Zelensky is, you know, potentially he's of a, well, he's certainly of a, let's put it this way, he's certainly of a generation much entirely younger than Putin. Mm. So Putin just turned 70. I think Zelensky's something like 48 like that. But that's the whole point, which is that he's of such a different generation, grew up in such a different information environment. And that's why his communication resonates with us so much more.
Mm. No, indeed. Indeed. And in fact, yeah, in the age of politicians at the moment, a lot of politicians are a lot older. There are now new exceptions to that. But yeah, it's quite an interesting point there.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Back to Putin. In September, President Vladimir Putin signed an accord to annex the occupied regions in Ukraine, and he vowed Russia would never give them up and he would defend them with all means available. So what is the significance of these annexations, and how far do you think Putin would go to kind of keep that territory he's now holding on to?
Yeah. Great question. Obviously, history is being written as we speak as far as what these annexations are, how Russia is going to respond, because nobody really knows.
Yeah.
All of the data we have so far is that Putin is before our eyes setting the precedent that you can take annexed sovereign Russian territory with no consequences. And that does not entail a nuclear strike on your country and things like that. And so the real danger that Putin is creating himself is that he himself has now made this precedent that you can retake these seized areas that he claims to have annexed without Russia really annexing significantly, other than what they're doing, the strikes on civilian infrastructure, et cetera. But it doesn't, despite their claims, they're not putting these territories under Russia's nuclear doctrine. Where that's going to get dangerous is, for example, if the Ukrainians, I don't know, a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, if the Ukrainians all of a sudden are on the doorstep of Crimea, and now they're pouring into Crimea, Putin is probably going to say, "Oh my gosh, this is sovereign Russian territory," all this stuff. But he has now set this precedent. He himself doesn't seem to recognize a difference between Crimea and the seized territories. Mm. Ukraine has also conducted strikes in Crimea that Russia has not responded to in a specific way. So, in my estimation, they're going to attempt this gymnastics where they're going to say, "Well, no, Crimea is different," but they've set a precedent where they've shown that it's not really different and that you can retake your territory. So that's the real kind of danger here, I think. I think that on the other hand, Russia will fight tooth and nail to defend the so-called Crimea land bridge, the land corridor. So through Kherson and Zaporizhia regions connecting the Donbas to Crimea. I think that's kind of the backup base case scenario for Putin to sell to the Russian people that, hey, we've still got a victory. And even just today, Putin still says that, hey, everything's going according to plan. And then they say, "Well, what's the plan?" And he goes, "Oh, well, the plan was to defend the Donbas and Crimea." So presumably he's taken those regions to better defend the Donbas and Crimea. And so I think that's those areas they're going to fight tooth and nail to defend, because losing them would then threaten Putin's own regime, because it will be much harder to sell the Russian people that this was a success. So
yeah, no, indeed. How are ordinary Russians viewing this at the moment, do you think?
It's hard to say, because getting sociological data was difficult in Russia before the invasion. Now it's arguably more difficult, just more difficult to get, period. And then B, we're even less trustful of the answers that are given. So basically, there's only one organization in Russia called the Levada Center that does polling that's considered credible. And, you know, they've shown that Putin's popularity is declining since the invasion. The invasion itself, people, the Russians are extreme, especially following the mobilization. The number of Russians who say they're concerned about the future has skyrocketed to, I think, something like 70%. But right now, kind of Putin's popularity is declining very slowly. I mean, we're talking about, you know, a percentage point or two each month. So it's a negative trend, but it's not very kind of sharp. And then, right, a lot of Russians, you know, are scared. I mean, they tend to, you know, hide their views if called up by a pollster, certainly. And then even in conversations with friends, I mean, they're scared of the return of the old Soviet practices of ratting out your neighbors to save yourself. And they've seen that even just today, another very recent example, Ksenia Sobchak, Putin's granddaughter. The daughter of the man who actually gave Putin his first job after the KGB in St. Petersburg in 1992. Well, she's fled Russia because there now is an attempt to most likely frame people associated with her with extortion and anti-Russian activity, and we're just seeing a constant flow of people labeled as enemy agents. And so, yeah, I mean, it's really hard to say, but the bottom line is that we have this big chunk of Russian people who are just turn themselves off from it because they don't want to think about it, and it's scary, but they're not willing to actually actively oppose anything.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of Oleg Gordievsky's biography. Oleg Gordievsky, former KGB agent who defected to the West, and he was an MI6 agent.
Yes.
And he talked about, like, in Russia, a lot of people would just use the crosswords and very benign things to have a conversation. Just never have a conversation about politics or about what you're actually thinking. It's always just going to be the crosswords or sport or something like that, and nothing more.
Yeah, you would only have those political conversations at your home, and preferably at your dacha, out your country home, where it was considered less likely that somebody was monitoring you. And then, you know, you would have them around, you know, a bottle of vodka or whatever form of illicit alcohol could be procured at the time. Mm. And yeah, you tried to keep these conversations kind of on very, you know, private settings.
Yeah, indeed. Turn the music up and talk low. So can you talk to us about the Ukrainian forces' victory in Kharkiv and its significance to in the larger war against Russian forces?
It's definitely significant because that offensive was one of the reasons it's successful, is that it was considered somewhat surprising, I think, to the Russian forces. They were caught off guard. Everybody was saying that militarily, the obvious place to counterattack would be in Kherson, where they could seize up to the river. Russian forces are more vulnerable and poorly supplied there. And then once they had secured up to the river, they could send those forces eastward. Russia started reinforcing Kherson. So Ukraine was kind of looking at what are our options. And there was essentially just a vulnerability there that the Ukrainians wanted to capitalize on. It appeared that a lot of the front was manned by these troops from the Luhansk People's Republic, so they weren't regular Russian army troops. These Luhansk people who thought that they had already liberated their homeland territory, their region, so why are they sitting in Kharkiv region, and they're poorly equipped, et cetera. And so the Ukrainians attacked there, and once they broke through, the Russians showed that they did not want to hold these territories, right? Because Russia hadn't yet annexed Kharkiv, and so they withdrew. Most significantly, the Russians withdrew from this city called Izyum, which had been kind of this supply hub for them. And then the loss of that bridgehead really reduced the threat to all the rest of the Ukrainian the Ukrainians hold in Donbass, because now there's no threat of those forces being encircled. The threat in the previous months is that all of Ukraine's best troops, their best supplies, best troops are still in Donbass, where they had been building fortifications and fortifying for years, right, since 2014. And the threat to them was them getting encircled in some, you know, major encirclement. But now that threat is completely gone. And as far as the main significance, I would probably say that it's the Ukrainians show that they can successfully counterattack. There was a lot of doubt about whether Ukraine actually could counterattack. The skeptics had said would say things like, well, Ukraine has never conducted a successful modern offensive in their history, right? I mean, this is, you're asking them to do something they've never done before against a better supplied, better equipped opponent, etc. And they destroyed that. And they showed that, you know, just a few Western weapons and will are able to, you know, overcome these challenges. And so I think it's very significant because it shows that this war is going to drag on, and the Ukrainians do have significant offensive capabilities. And it, of course, was a big lift to Ukraine because they've already proved to their people that they can liberate their territory.
Yeah. We've obviously talked a little bit about the winter and its sort of potential bleak kind of view from a military perspective. But obviously there's a talk of, in Europe, we've got sort of rising energy costs because of gas shortages. And in certain parts of Europe, there is a desire to give Putin at least a part of what he wants in Ukraine. And in the US, with your midterm elections coming up, you've got Republicans who've expressed a desire to limit or reduce military aid to Ukraine. So what do you think the winter has ahead, maybe politically, in store for Russia and Ukraine and Western support?
Yeah, this is really the key question, because I think that in an environment where Russia can't win on the battlefield, Putin's only clear path to victory is breaking Western unity, breaking Western support, making the West supply fewer weapons and ammunition to Ukraine. Because if the Western support, if the ammunition stops flowing, then Ukraine can't counterattack. That's even a big kind of a big turning point, right? The West can continue to supply Ukraine enough ammunition to defend itself, but if it's not going to supply enough ammunition to attack, then you know it's kind of the Ukrainians are not incentivized to continue attacking. They're incentivized to sit back and say, okay, well, we have to accept our fate. So right, Russia wants to even marginally begin to reduce that Western support. Basically, the idea is that if Putin can use energy blackmail, rising energy prices, threat of political destabilization in Europe, mass protests, falling energy cutoffs, then those governments will become more likely to stop supplying. Right, want to save more money at home to stop supplying Ukraine, or just for political reasons, preemptively say that hey, we should have negotiations with Putin. Let's reduce our military support. The way it seems to me is that it's not going to work out that way. I mean, there's a lot of debate about whether Putin needs this to peak this winter. Like, for example, if this doesn't work this winter, the Europe survives this heating season. Does that mean all of Putin's leverage is gone, or does he seem to think that he can draw this out for 3, 4, 5, 6 heating seasons and kind of keep this pressure in a kind of a pressure cooker for years? I mean, that's kind of the really difficult question. I tend to think that Putin would like to peak this as soon as possible, and so if that's the case, then he's more likely to engage in even more energy cutoffs. Right, so they've already blown up the Nord Stream pipelines, but there's more. The very obvious next step for Russia would be to destroy the pipelines through Ukraine. Something like 40 million cubic meters a day of Russian gas are still transported through Ukraine and sold to the EU countries, and Ukraine gets transit fees on that gas every single day. And it's even causing uproar within Russia. They go, oh my gosh, we're at war with this country. Why are we still paying the Ukrainians to send our gas? So, I mean, it's very clear that that's the next thing that would go. The one bright spot potentially for Europe is that Russia's flows through Turkey on the Turkstream pipeline. Those are unlikely to be cut off, because who does that go to? That goes to Turkey, Serbia, and Hungary, right? Three states that have shown more of this geopolitical alignment with Putin. And if Putin cuts off their gas, then they're going, well, hold on, wait, why are we even, you know, maintaining our kind of vague pro-Russian lines or continuing to talk for dialogue with Putin, right? I mean, now they've cut us off of the one thing we presumed was our benefit of doing that. So I think that Putin is unlikely to end gas, at least on that route. To sum up and directly answer your question, I don't think that that we are going to see protests in Europe, and it's going to get ugly this winter. Like, let's have no mistakes about that. Bills are going to rise. There's going to be protests. We're already seeing kind of a dress rehearsal or a taste of that in Moldova. Actually, there's a big protest movement there, all about high energy prices, high gas prices. wants the government to change course. And I think Putin is signaling through Moldova, hey, Germany, that this could be you, right, in this December if you don't change course. But I just don't think it's going to be successful. And one of the reasons why is that I think that European politicians are going to probably say that, look, if we get through this winter, that's it. You know, then we've already reduced our reliance on Russian energy, economics, like something like 75%. And then they'll go, look, the hardest time is already over. Now would be precisely the wrong time to change course, because we've already ridded him of his leverage. And so, of course, it would be a mistake to backtrack only once, right, our leverage is now higher. So I'm skeptical that it's going to work, and I think that most of these European governments are going to make it through.
Mm. One quick question popped into my head whilst you're chatting there was about Russian-Turkish relations, because am I right in thinking that Ukraine are using a lot of Turkish-manufactured drones at the moment? Obviously, now Russia's using Iranian drones, which is another interesting thing. Now, I don't know if you've got any thoughts on their relations there.
Oh, absolutely. This is a topic that we've been covering extensively on our website. So people interested in this, I would encourage to check out our work on this. But yes, Turkey, of course, has a very interesting relationship with Russia, where, you know, Turkey, like any one of these countries that, you know, claims to be a civilization state that has its own ideas of its sphere of influence, et cetera, of course, expanding through the whole Turkish world, through the Caucasus into Central Asia, Kazakhstan, even within Russia, Turkic-speaking peoples, et cetera. You know, Turkey is going to do things, is going to play itself off in order to get the best deal, right? And so, yes, Turkey is reliant on Russia for a lot of things, cheap energy for a lot of things. But Ukraine, but they're also extremely supportive of Ukraine, right? They're at the vanguard of not recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea, for example, as you mentioned, arming Ukraine. But they want to use their position between the West and Russia to do things for themselves and ensure their own kind of stability, because Turkey also used to be a major buyer of both Russian and Ukrainian agricultural products. And they want to use this whole situation to further Turkey's interest and their prestige. And of course, if they can use their grain deal that they helped broker to serve as the base for a broader peace agreement eventually in the future, then that's certainly kind of something in their interests. On the other hand, the underlying factor is that, you know, Turkey would potentially stand to benefit from Russia losing the war, right? That would mean a Russia that's more inward-looking, less focused, less able to project its influence on the Caucasus in Central Asia. And those are sphere of influences that where Turkey could very easily come in and kind of from a geoeconomic standpoint begin to expand its influence. So, you know, Turkey realizes that all sides are aware of Turkey's position, and so Turkey is going to constantly kind of be this go-between Russia and the West.
Yeah, actually, think about President Turkey. Quite an interesting kind of character, because he seems to look at Turkish history as an influence for the future, potentially. So do you think we might be seeing the beginnings of a new Ottoman-esque empire in the works? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. You know, neo-Ottoman thinking. Absolutely. I recall that I believe at the... So basically after Azerbaijan won the second Nagorno-Karabakh war against Armenia in 2020. Of course, there was all these victory celebrations in Baku and Azerbaijan. And when Erdogan, attended a lot of these ceremonies, was showing his close ties with Aliyev, the Azerbaijani dictator. And when he was there, I believe during one of these military marches, they played the marching anthem of the Ottoman Empire, right? It's almost like a not even a veiled kind of, you know, reference to these kind of pan-Turkic, ideas. And yeah, he does look upon that fondly, particularly in the context of Erdogan being a more religious figure as opposed to the secular Kemalist state and ideas. So yeah, I mean, that's what this is really all about. And I should be, and who was the biggest enemy of the Ottoman Empire? It was Imperial Russia. It was Catherine the Great. It was the expansion of the Russian Empire. So if Turkey is calling itself neo-Ottoman and is embracing those ideas, then Russia is the inevitable country that they're going to be in conflict with. So that's why, you know, you keep your friends close, but your enemies closer kind of thing is what's going on there.
Yeah, okay. I can foresee future podcasts on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh my goodness. Well, so it feels like Putin's war on Ukraine is really about him, his reputation, and his holding on to power. So how far do you think Putin is likely to go to get what he wants and to hold on to power?
This is, again, you're hitting the key questions. There's kind of two options here, right? One option would be de-escalation, right? So what that looks like is Russia, you know, saying it's going to escalate, making threats to a certain extent. But when push comes to shove, if it's losing on the battlefield, it just retreats, engages in threatening things or destructive actions that it's already engaged in, right? For example, these strikes on civilian infrastructure. But it just allows itself to lose on the battlefield slowly but surely. And then eventually retreats back into its territory. For a long time, I didn't think that that was possible, but I've also noticed a slight change in Putin's rhetoric. And there was a big forum out in Vladivostok maybe in August or several weeks ago. And he said something to the effect of, well, they asked him, hey, well, what's the biggest benefit of the special military operation, as it's called in Russia? And he goes, well, look, I mean, the biggest benefit is not even what's happening in Ukraine. It's that we've increased our sovereignty. And what Putin means by increasing our sovereignty is, you know, cutting off our connections with the West, right? Repressing internal dissent voices, right? So it was almost this shift to saying that the biggest benefits of the war are actually just internal changes that I wanted to make but didn't have the excuse to do.
Yeah.
And if Putin leans into that rhetoric, that's how he would explain something like a de-escalation, right? It would be like, hey, look, like, you know, this is unfortunate. We wanted things to go better. But look, we've evacuated these pro-Russian people from Ukraine. So he would still say that I've saved the Russians or saved the people. And then he would just use their pervasive propaganda apparatus and hardcore repressions to instill that reality that this was, hey, we still benefited. We still realize these things. So I think that that's possible. I think if you asked me way back in like March, I would have said like no way something like that's possible. But I'm becoming increasingly, I think that it's very unlikely but possible. But unfortunately, much more likely in my estimation is a scenario where he goes for escalation. So there are ways that he could escalate. Obviously, militarily, it would be deepening the mobilization, right? So doing a full mobilization, for example, declaring war on Ukraine, although there's a lot of mobilization steps before that. Of course, the energy blackmail, stepping that up, which I think is also quite likely. And then the real one that I think you really wanted to get to is the nuclear escalation, right? The nuclear blackmail. So there are a lot of ways that nuclear blackmail could look, right? The recent dirty bomb talk is just the latest flavor at the ice cream store about that. And I think it's no coincidence that the dirty bomb talk came simultaneously with the threatening movements of Russia's regular nuclear forces that Western reports had been referencing for a while. That the Belgorod class submarine with the nuclear tipped torpedoes had left port in the Arctic Ocean, or that we observed strange movements on Russian rail of Russian nuclear assets. We didn't get what that was about. And then 2 days ago, Russia announced, told the US that, oh, we're actually conducting our annual nuclear triad deterrence test. And so I think that the connection of the dirty bond to that test was about showing, look, I mean, we will do a nuclear retaliatory strike even on the most flimsy of grounds, right? And that's what I think that this dirty bomb thing is about. It's everybody knows that it's already ridiculous, but the ridiculousness is the point. It's like before the invasion, Russia was saying, well, yes, we have evidence that Ukraine's about to use chemical weapons in the Donbass, right?
Yeah.
The absurdity is precisely the source of the leverage and the threat, because it's saying, even on the most flimsy grounds that the international community, even if you think our narrative is so flimsy, we'll still do this. And that's precisely why you should be scared. So I tend to think that the line for that for Putin is going to be Crimea. I don't know how long it takes. It's probably not going to happen next year. I think we're looking at a war that could drag on for years and years. But, you know, eventually, if strikes on Crimea become more common or the Ukrainian forces are threatening Crimea, Putin is going to attempt to really ramp that nuclear stuff kind of to level five. They could raise the nuclear threat level, for example. They've only done that once. And just hours after the start of the invasion, they raised the nuclear threat level from the lowest level to one level above. But there's actually two more levels they could still go to. And I think Putin is going to try to do that. It could either come this winter. At some point, if he tries to have all this leverage appear at some sort of a crescendo, maybe around January or February, or the next opportunity would be to try to say, okay, Crimea is different from the rest of Ukraine, or maybe the land bridge is now different from. But the whole thing is that these distinctions are arbitrary because they've already left areas that they claim to have annexed since they are Russian sovereign territory.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, that does paint quite a bleak picture there. And I was just thinking of that. I don't know if it's the same in the US, but there's a particular day in January that's considered the biggest sort of blue day for depression and things like that. So better keep an eye out around then, I think.
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, indeed. Well, do you think, obviously, we talk a lot about Putin. Do we think we're any closer to seeing the end of Putin? And if he does go, will things get any better?
Yeah, I think that. So when we think about kind of Putin and succession, I think that at this time, basically, if the replacement for Putin at this time would be a more hardline, essentially more hawkish person. The attack line, the dominant attack line on Putin at this time is that. I mean, look, if escalation is our only way to win, why are we waiting to escalate? We're just gonna take a bunch of extra, lose a bunch of extra men and money for several more months or years, and then escalate to end the war and win. Well, we shouldn't wait a bunch of extra. If that's what it takes to win, we should do it now. And people have publicly kind of indicated that. The head of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, had said we should use tactical nukes in Ukraine and called for, you know, more escalation. There's this guy, Yevgeny Prigozhin, sometimes erroneously referred to as Putin's chef, but the head of the Wagner group, has been kind of playing a lot of these escalatory things, has criticized Putin's pursuit of the war, etc. And I think that so long as the war has not been shown to be a failure within Russia, and so long as Putin is, you know, alive, there's really no way that Putin could be replaced by somebody more liberal than him or somebody willing to de-escalate. I don't think that there's a real threat to Putin. We have to talk about who could possibly coup Putin. The military is way too scared and does not have enough political weight to do that. In my estimation, I don't think even there's not. Now we have the first time this general Surovikin, who's trying to become a public figure now because he runs the whole operation, but he's not going to be taken seriously. And then there's nobody else within the military who has the confidence that they could pull this off. So of course the coup would have to come from the FSB. And then if you're talking about the FSB, it's kind of similar questions. It's like, you know, one of us could pull this off, but who's going to do it? I mean, it's way too scary to attempt to organize something like this, but it's something that Russia's scared of. I'm lucky that for this interview where we've had a lot of recent news that's been perfectly illustrating the points, but just yesterday there was a big, what they called a training exercise in Moscow around the Kremlin of a bunch of riot police vehicles and military vehicles simulating like the government's reaction to some sort of coup or a event in the Kremlin. Mm. So there's these indications that potentially the Kremlin is preparing for something like this just in case. But I don't think that at this time that the FSB could anybody within the organization could pull that off. So I think that. Yeah, I mean, as in general, it's really hard to see the Russia's political course changing. I think it's either going to be stability or even more hardline forces coming to power. The only way a liberal or a force for de-escalation could come to power, clearly for kind of de-escalation, would be if Putin dies suddenly and the operation has already been recognized as a failure within the country, right? Then you would have the conditions where, right, people would be looking for somebody to assume power. not from the failed kind of establishment, but those conditions are definitely not met at this time.
Yeah. And do you think, I suppose, like, I could always think of like the end of World War One and Germany and what went wrong there. So obviously there's a lot of sanctions against Russia at the moment. Could some of the sanctions be reversed as a kind of not an appeasement, what's the word I want, a cherry on the cake, something to kind of encourage a positive change in Russia? Yeah,
just as a policy question, I think it absolutely should be. I do kind of wish that Western, I mean, they've essentially said that, right? They've said that if, you know, Russia leaves Ukraine, then, you know, we can take the sanctions off. But I think that, you know, especially months from now, when these questions, I think, will be more apropos, it would be nice that if Western leaders reminded, you know, Putin or Russian leadership, hey, you know, if you de-escalate, if you leave Ukraine, of course, there's an avenue to remove the sanctions. And then of course, if a liberal government somehow, some way came to power, then of course it would be imperative to remove the sanctions and help improve Russia's economy and essentially correct the mistakes of the 1990s, where instead of a Marshall Plan for the Soviet Union and to prevent kind of the rise of this ultra-nationalist, essentially fascist Russia, you know, all efforts need to be made to help Russia economically, to have the West, Russia's return to the international community be seen as economically positive for Russians.
Indeed. I mean, it feels like, because there's a lot of, Russia seems to be, at least with Putin, he seems to be very reliant on this sort of anti-Western rhetoric that's been basically pumped into Russia for the last sort of 20 years. And I'm trying to figure out ways one could, for the future, kind of put a stop to that. And does that mean, do we need to consider getting, I don't know, controversially, Russia into the EU or Russia into NATO or something crazy like that? I feel like we need some sort of, left field thinking going on.
Yeah, I think we do. I mean, NATO and the EU still have their open door policies, and I don't think that anybody in either organization is trying to bar. Well, no, I should restate that there are people who would want to bar Russia outright from those organizations, but I don't think that view will prevail, and I don't think it's the right view. And I think that a real sincere prospect of kind of deeper integration of Russia into the West should be offered to Russia, or if that's politically unpopular in Russia, if that's has all kinds of issues, then I mean the state of the relationship beforehand should be equally, you know, we should make things short of that also very attractive to Russia, right? I mean the EU should offer very favorable trade terms with Russia. And, you know, NATO, of course, had an entire dialogue with Format. And if you read the Russian NATO Founding Act from 1997, I believe, I mean, it's very clear that, you know, NATO, you know, has a positive view towards Russia, and NATO doesn't want to threaten Russia, and NATO doesn't have pretensions on Russia's territorial integrity, which is notable now because in theory, right, if you go back in history, there's tons of even NATO countries that would say that they have territorial pretensions against Russia, right? Finland, Estonia come to mind. So, there's a lot of very obvious things that I think that the West, you know, could offer and should offer to integrate Russia into the West. I hope that in that scenario, although I should reiterate now at this time, I don't think that this is, we're thinking very many years down the road, those things should be on the table. Just as generally, I think that there, and this is what a lot of Russians liberals have actually said. They've said one of the hardest things about our job in Russia right now is that the West is not yet offering an alternative to Russia. They've said that the West should continue its current course vis-a-vis Ukraine and Russia, but simultaneously they should openly offer this is the size of the economic package we would offer Russia if they forewent their invasion of Ukraine and showed interest with reintegration, right? If you put that offer hard on the table, also have it have security aspects, you could do a draft of the renewed Russian NATO Founding Act, an updated text. I think those two elements would be so key in really allowing a lot of the liberals in Russia who still, it's not impossible that they come to power. There's German Greff and there's Kudrin, and there are these kind of high respected, more liberal people within Russia that have not been, you know, disgraced and removed from their jobs, etc. And so, you know, if you have a perspective like that out, I think that it would be very attractive and it would be helpful for everyone.
Yeah, indeed, because something needs to challenge Putinism, because it's gone on for too long, and it doesn't bode well for the future if whoever succeeds Putin still believes the nonsense he's been pumping out. So something needs to change.
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Matthew, thank you so much today. Where can listeners sort of find out more about you and your work at Rain?
Yeah, so if you go to rainnetwork.com, that's Rain, R-A-N-E, you'll find everything related to our company. Our articles are still present on our website called Stratfor, so that's stratfor.com. And yes, I encourage anybody to subscribe and read to us. We offer our up to 3 articles a month for free. And then, of course, if you get a subscription, then you can read all of our content on our website that we publish. We have analysts covering the whole world who are writing on geopolitics in even countries that often escape the eye of the Western press. But so I really think that it's a great value for people who are interested in geopolitics and want to really get under the surface and get past kind of the surface level reporting that you would see in free media.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining us today. It's been great to have you on.
Thanks, Chris.
For listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hi guys, here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil, like a lot of it. Yep, that's good. Then, I stare at a red light. It's the kind that helps your cells positively glow. Oh, wow, really bright, okay. Next, I take an ice bath. That's how you melt your fat and fix your, I don't know, other stuff. Ooh, yep, feeling super healthy. Can't feel my toes. Breakfast is raw liver. Okay, here we go. Oh, real good.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear, just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at cygnos.com. That's Cygnos.com with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.